Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day on the internet and on the radio to help you learn and improve your American English skills. At the same time, we tell you about interesting things going on in our world. This is an important year for American politics. In November, voters will choose a new president of the United States. The Republican Party has many possible candidates. On the Democratic side, many people are wondering if this will be the year that we elect our first woman president. As the candidates travel around the country to make speeches and talk about their ideas for the future, they are often asked questions by potential voters. These questions give us an idea of what issues Americans consider the most important. Well, better jobs, pay, and the economy are the top issues for voters, according to a Voice of America informal study. VOA listened to the questions that voters ask presidential candidates. These are questions voters ask at rallies and meetings. Rallies were recently held in New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, and Illinois. Of all the questions voters asked of candidates, 27% were about the economy. What plans do you have to create better-paying jobs than minimum wage? A man asked Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders in Iowa last week. Health care came in second most asked, at 15% of the questions. Concerns about immigration came in at 12%. Just 10% of the questions asked of the candidates were about national security or terrorism. A Gallup poll in December found 16% of Americans listed terrorism as their top concern. VOA observed that Republicans were more likely to ask about terrorism than Democrats. Sometimes the issues were connected or overlapped. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who is a Republican and says he wants to be president, was asked about terrorism and gun violence. It may score political points to mention ISIS and the threats to America, but more people have been killed in America by homegrown extremists than by international terrorists, a man said to Christie. When do we consider gun violence a credible threat to our safety and security? Candidates were often asked about the Second Amendment. That amendment states that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Many Americans interpret or define it different ways. This has led to conflict about gun use in America. More people were killed in America in the past 10 years by guns, 280,000, than by terrorism, 24, according to numerous news sources and confirmed by PolitiFact. PolitiFact is a fact-checking website that rates the accuracy of claims by elected officials and others who speak up in American politics. It is staffed by editors and reporters at the Tampa Bay Times. Democratic contenders were often asked to assist in solving problems aligned with their party. For example, Hillary Clinton repeatedly hears questions on health care insurance and the economy. Republican candidates were more likely to be asked about welfare abuse and immigration. Questions about climate were asked 5% of the time. Race issues were asked 2.5% of all questions. Republican candidate Donald Trump was not part of the VOA study. He does not field questions from audiences at his campaign events. You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Now, let's talk about money and Zimbabwe. There has been a surprise announcement from the African country that is a bit unusual. Mary Gottschall has the story for us.
Zimbabwe announced last week that it would shift to the Chinese yuan as its reserve currency. A reserve currency is a foreign currency held in large quantities by governments and financial institutions to pay international debts. Reserve currency is held in order to support the value of national currencies, writes Justin Kipper, international investing expert, on the website International Invest. Patrick Chinamasa is Zimbabwe's Minister of Finance and Economic Development. He said China agreed to cancel about $40 million of Zimbabwe's debts this year. He also said the move was a sign of the friendship between China and Zimbabwe, a poor country in southern Africa. It is also a sign of the growing economic ties between China and Zimbabwe. China is Zimbabwe's largest foreign investor, with interests ranging from construction and energy to telecommunications. China has also become the largest exporter of Zimbabwean products, mainly tobacco and minerals, such as gold and diamonds. Local economists said Zimbabwe is flooded with foreign currencies since the inflated Zimbabwean dollar collapsed in 2009. In 2014, the nation's central bank permitted traders to use the U.S. dollar, the South African rand, Botswana's pula, the British pound, the euro, the Australian dollar, the Indian rupee, the Japanese yen, and the Chinese yuan. Business consultant Philip Ciccone says this announcement is unlikely to change things for the businessmen with whom he works. "I don't think it will make much difference to anyone, as we're already using foreign currencies," he said. Zimbabwe has used the yuan as a legal currency for 2 years, but Ciccone said he has not seen it used. Instead, most traders prefer the stability of the U.S. dollar, which is being used as the country's major currency. The market was stabilized by the U.S. dollar, but Zimbabwe's cost of living is still about 60% higher than that of neighboring South Africa. Bank ABC chief economist James Wade says the yuan increases Zimbabwe's options. "It's not like we're forcing people to use the Chinese yuan," he said. "We are expanding options that they can use." And he notes, the context matters. China's president made a state visit to Zimbabwe this month and signed many economic agreements. This included a billion-dollar loan for a thermal power plant. If this action brings in more Chinese investment and more development, Zimbabweans will profit, no matter what currency they use. I'm Mary Gottschall.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Now, Mary Gottschall joins us again for a report on economic issues. The United States has begun exporting oil again after years of an export ban. That makes the world's biggest oil producer an exporter as well. Mary tells us a little of the history that led to the export ban and reasons why it has been lifted.
The U.S. made its first export of crude oil in four decades last Thursday. The exports were banned in the mid-1970s. That ban was lifted a few weeks ago. The Arab oil embargo began in 1973. Arab nations who produce oil dramatically limited their shipments to the U.S. This was done to punish the U.S. over its military support for Israel. The Arab cartel later expanded the embargo to other countries, and oil prices soared worldwide. By the time it ended in 1974, the price of oil had risen from $3 per barrel to nearly $12 globally. U.S. prices were much higher. The embargo had many short and long-term effects on global politics and the global economy. The skyrocketing prices led to a drop in demand for oil. Countries looked to alternative energy sources, such as natural gas, nuclear energy, and coal, says the Gale Encyclopedia of U.S. Economic History. Oil-producing nations outside the Middle East increased their production and relied more on domestic supply. The embargo set U.S. energy policy on a path that still guides us 40 years later, wrote Robert Rapier in an article on the website oilprice.com. That website reports oil and energy news. Every president since Nixon has made energy security a top priority, he continued. But each president has dealt with the problem in different ways. President Barack Obama has looked for energy sources apart from imported oil, such as natural gas, from wells in the U.S. In addition, the U.S. produces 9.2 million barrels of oil per day, close to 10% of the world oil supply, according to the U.S. Energy Information Agency. Oil prices are near an 11-year low, reports the Oil Price Information Service. U.S. oil now sells for around $37 per barrel. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries is currently selling its oil for about $32 per barrel. OPEC is an organization of 12 oil-exporting nations. Its members are Algeria, Angola, Ecuador, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Libya, Nigeria, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Venezuela. I'm Mary Gottschall.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 1892 was a presidential election year in the United States. In that year, most parts of the American economy were expanding, but one part was not doing well: agriculture. The result was the birth of a new political party. It was called the People's Party. Its members were called populists. This week in our series, Stan Busby and Morris Joyce tell about the populists and how they campaigned against the Republicans and Democrats in the election.
In the late 1880s, a North Carolina farming publication described America's economy this way: "There is something radically wrong in our industrial system. The railroads are making much money, yet agriculture is failing. The banks are doing great business, yet agriculture is failing. Towns and cities grow, yet agriculture is failing. Wages were never so high, yet agriculture is failing." Historians give four major reasons why agriculture was failing in the late 1880s. One was the high cost of transportation. Second was high taxes. Third was falling prices for agricultural products. And fourth was the high cost of borrowing money.
Farmers began to organize to discuss their problems. They formed local groups called alliances. An alliance member described the result of these discussions: "People began to think who had never thought before. People talked who had never spoken much. Little by little, they began to study their condition. They discussed taxes on income, government ownership of property, the unity of labor, and a thousand other opposing ideas."
Local alliances formed larger groups. The larger groups included many persons who were not farmers, but who lived and worked in agricultural areas. These included teachers, doctors, repairmen, reporters, and church leaders. In 1889, the major alliances held separate conventions in St. Louis, Missouri. They refused to form one big alliance. They were divided on several important issues.
The chief issue was political. Leaders of the Northern Alliance had decided that agricultural interests could expect little help from either the Republican or Democratic parties. They believed the answer to their problems was a third national political party. Leaders of the Southern Alliance disagreed. They belonged to the Democratic Party. And at that time, Democrats faced little opposition in the South. A new party would weaken their political power. So they wanted to work for change within the existing Democratic Party.
Another issue dividing the Northern and Southern alliances was racial. How would a united alliance deal with black farmers? The Southern Alliance did not permit black members, and it did not want blacks in a united alliance. The Northern Alliance said blacks could join. The two groups could not settle their differences before the state and congressional elections of 1890. So they did not campaign as one party, but they campaigned for one idea: help for America's farmers. throughout the South and Middle West. They succeeded in electing agricultural candidates as governors, state legislators, senators, and members of the House of Representatives.
Farm leaders everywhere were surprised by their election victories in 1890. They had not expected to win so much so quickly. Leaders of the Northern Alliance decided the time was right to form one party to represent all farmers. They felt sure of success. For now, enough leaders of the Southern Alliance were willing to support the idea. These Southern leaders had succeeded within the Democratic Party, but they quickly learned that they held political power only at the local level. They held almost no power at the national level. So, a few months before the presidential election of 1892, America's agricultural alliances held a joint convention in Omaha, Nebraska. They formed a new party. They called it the People's Party. They called themselves populists.
Delegates to the convention approved a policy statement for the new party. The statement said the national government should own the country's railroads, telegraph, and telephone systems. It said the government, not banks, should supply paper money. And it said no limits should be put on government production of silver money. The populists called for a tax on earnings, fewer working hours for labor, controls on immigration. To help farmers, the populists demanded what they called the sub-treasury plan. Under this plan, farmers could put their crops in government storehouses. Then they could wait to sell the crops until prices rose. While they waited, they could borrow money from the government at low cost. They would pay back the loans when they sold their crops.
The new People's Party also proposed ways to make government more democratic. It said secret ballots should be used in all elections. It said senators should be elected by the people, not chosen by state legislatures. Most Americans considered populist proposals extreme. They felt the proposals were too close to socialism or communism. The populists considered their proposals just. They felt their movement was a struggle for more equal control of the nation. On one side of the struggle were producers. These included farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. They were led by the new People's Party. On the other side were what populists called non-producers. These included wealthy bankers and leaders of industry. They were led by the Republican and Democratic parties. Populists wanted producers to have some of the political power traditionally held by non-producers. They wanted producers to get a fairer share of the nation's increasing wealth.
The People's Party chose James Weaver as its candidate in the presidential election of 1892. Weaver had been an officer in the Union Army during America's Civil War. He had served in the House of Representatives, and he had been the candidate of a minor party in the presidential election of 1880. The Republican Party renominated President Benjamin Harrison, and the Democratic Party nominated former President Grover Cleveland.
The campaign began quietly, but a few months before the election, a labor dispute exploded into an important campaign issue. Several thousand steel workers went on strike at a factory owned by the Carnegie Steel Company in Homestead, Pennsylvania. The steel workers' union called the strike after failing to reach a wage agreement with company officials. After months of growing tension, the head of the company sent 300 private security officers to break up the strike and protect non-union workers. The security officers and many of the strikers carried guns. Shots were fired. 10 men were killed. The governor of Pennsylvania immediately sent state soldiers to the steel factory. After a few more attempts to continue the strike, the union admitted defeat. Its power was crushed. It would be more than 40 years before America's steelworkers were organized again.
A short time later, state soldiers were used to break up a strike by railroad workers in New York, and federal soldiers were used against striking silver miners in Idaho. This use of government troops to end strikes caused many citizens to vote against the ruling Republican Party. They voted for the opposition Democratic or People's Parties instead. In the election of 1892, Republican President Benjamin Harrison was defeated. Democrat Grover Cleveland, who had lost to Harrison 4 years earlier, would be president again. The People's Party candidate, James Weaver, won 1 million popular votes and 22 electoral votes.
Grover Cleveland returned to the White House just as his wife had said he would. But his second administration would be much more difficult than his first. Within 2 months of Cleveland's inauguration, the United States entered into one of the worst economic depressions in its history. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Stan Busby and Morris Joyce. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.